Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who can't show his face in his village ever again. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Hello, London. How are we doing? Last one at the Leicester Square Theatre. You're much better than last week's audience. There was a crazy person in last week, just kept on making weird noises. Like they were a clown horn or something. Thank goodness they're not here. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to Cy from off of Gangnam Style. He does a dance and then he calls it Rahalastapa. So he does a funny. He does a dance. He does a dance. Got nothing. I used all my jokes up last week. Nothing's happened to me in the last week. I've been writing my my sitcom. There's 10 days to the first record. I've got 5 scripts. I have 6. Is this fine? We'll get there. And I should say, do a perfect Christmas gift if it's not now, past Christmas, at home. Would you rather, Richard Herring's Would You Rather book, Richard Herring's The Problem With Men, is also available in paperback. Yes. Yes, it's like my penis. It's not hard. So let's have a little look around. So there's a lady avoiding my gaze here. Hello, what's your name? You're shocked. It's so rare for me to talk about my penis, isn't it? She's a little bit shocked I talked about my penis. It's the last show. Would you want to have a little look at it? What's your name? I should ask your name first.
Camilla.
Camilla, that's nice, isn't it? And are you called Charles? Come on. It would be great. Camilla, what do you do for a living, Camilla? Something
Well, I bet last week's show all about white privilege. I bet you were sitting there embarrassed, weren't you, Camilla? About that? What? She did say, don't feel guilty about your massive estate. What do you do? What do you do for a living? You're an opera singer. Check your privilege. What's the best? I can sing a bit of light opera. Do you want to? I'm trying to remember something. I used to do the bird catcher for. I can't remember. I can do Dick de Lieber. Ich gralle nicht, und wenn das Herz auch prickt, ewig verlorene Lieb. How's that? No, not so good. I've lost my nice, I'm a baritone. You got any? Do you want me to come and do some singing up in the opera? What opera are you in at the moment?
Lots of little bits.
Lots of little bits.
Not much call for opera at the moment, unfortunately.
Is there any ever call for opera? I mean, it's unnecessary. I think we can agree it's not necessary. I think we can agree nobody who goes to it has a nice time. Can't we? We can agree that. We can agree that, can't we, Camilla? They're dying, yeah. Fair enough. You carry on with your opera. It might lead to some. Maybe you'll get on Pop Stars, like Darius. It might work out well. Hey, look, let's crack on. It's lovely to thank you for coming, Camilla. It's lovely to meet you. I respect you so much, I'm not even going to show you my penis. That is how. My guest this week is probably best known for her appearance on A Kick Up the 80s. It's Miriam Margolyes, ladies and gentlemen. It's Miriam Margolyes. Miriam Margolyes. Fantastic. How lovely to see you.
Thank you. Oh, I have to use this.
You have to stick that up near your face.
I didn't understand any of what you said just
good.
Now.
Good, it's a good job.
It was fascinating.
I tried to sing some light opera, but I forgot.
Is
all
that
of it.
What it
I was?
I was
trying, yeah. I forgot every bit of light opera.
I heard this wailing, and I thought, oh, dear.
Well, look, Miriam, it is absolutely wonderful to have you here. I think this is going to be a very interesting evening.
Fucking hope so, mate.
We had, I don't know if you know him very well, we had an actor called Brian Blessed.
Of course I do. He's
on
lovely.
A few years ago. I feel we may beat... I mean, you were in Blackadder with Brian Blessed, weren't you?
I was just in, yes. Yeah. And he's wonderful, and it was great fun. Do you all remember Blackadder? It's a long time ago.
It was set, it was actually recorded in the 14th century, right? So it was.
And I was there.
Well, we might talk about that later. I want to say, I'll say it right at the start. This book, your book, This Much Is True. Which, if it's all true, it's unbelievable, some of it. But I do believe it because...
It is true.
You're very honest. You've got a fantastic memory. You're very, very indiscreet, Miriam.
Only about me.
Occasionally about others. And apparently there's some stuff the lawyers wouldn't let her put in. And that makes my... We may try and get to that... within the podcast.
By the way, it is half price at Tesco and Sainsbury's. So, if you would be so kind as to buy it, I'd be so delighted. Thank you.
It's a proper book. Look, this is Emma's book from last week.
That looks like a pamphlet more than a book.
I started work on that a month ago so that I could properly... And now I've forgotten most of the stuff that I read a month ago, but it's a fantastic read.
I want to tell you before you start, darling, sorry. There is another actress who's written a book which is absolutely wonderful. It's better than mine. I hate her for it. Her name is Eileen Atkins. And if you don't know her, she's the greatest actress working in England today, bar none. And her book is absolutely wonderful. It's called Will She Do? Will She Do? And it's about her early years before she became what she is now, a dame. She is a dame of, I suppose, the British Empire, is it? Just like Maggie Smith and Judi Dench and those other small people. She she is a dame, and I do beg you, when you've bought mine, buy hers, because it's wonderful. Well, I can't see anybody. Why don't they put the lights
it's
up?
It's for the best, Miriam. You don't want to see these people.
But
it's
can
not,
they see me? Can
they
you
can,
see
They
me?
Can see you. Well, there's lights on us. We keep them in the dark for a reason, Miriam. Ah. We put the sexy, beautiful people up here.
What are the others like?
Now, I what I enjoyed, as I do with many books, is having it read to me by the author. So I actually listened to the audiobook version, which is and just listening to you talk to the audience there. It must have taken you a long time to do, because it took me a long time to listen to it, and it probably took double that time. And beautifully read.
Well, it's one of my things.
Yeah.
I have a wonderful voice, and I can't sing like the lady in the opera that does opera here.
Yeah.
I can't sing, but I can talk mellifluously and with clarity, so you can hear every word. Would you agree with that?
It is. It's
good, thank you.
I'm sure they'll line it out, but there's a little bit in the audiobook where they've left a retake in, and I'm actually glad they did, because you go, is that the correctest way to do that? Let's do that again. And there's a little bit of your professionalism left in due to the unprofessionalism of the people who put the audiobook together.
I didn't know that. No. How wonderful. I love things like that.
I love things like that. And it usually happens with an audiobook, because they're so complicated to put together and they're so long to put together that there's usually a mistake. Well, talking of your voice, let's start with... there's things that people, I think, will be surprised that you did, because they won't necessarily... You've done a lot of voiceovers. And one of the voiceovers, which people may know about, you were the Cadbury's Bunny, which...
I was. I mean... That was a long time ago, of course. Now my voiceover is Anusol's Suppositories.
Which you could use a Cadbury's Caramel for, to be fair.
And they gave me a whole carton of them. I'm not quite sure why, if I look as if I need them or something. But I've been passing them out to friends.
It's the Cadbury's Bunny, though, is one of those formative experiences. I was a young man when that came on, and you know that's the result of my rabbit fetish that I have. I can only have sex with very sexy cartoon rabbits now as a result of that. Can you remember the voice you did for that? Are you able to recreate the? Because it might. I'm just warning you, there may be some trouser action.
You talk about your penis a lot. Don't you? I was listening backstage and rather nervously as what was about to pop out. I think it must be very difficult sometimes for blokes, because you've got this dangle and there it is, sort of somewhere on the left or occasionally somewhere on the right. And... It seems to have a life of its own.
It does.
Whereas we're all tidy. We've got a little envelope to put things in, you know. Well, Cadbury's Bunny.
Did she have a little envelope as well?
I think she did.
Yeah.
My memory of it was... It was sort of faintly rural like that, and it was "Hello, Mr. Rabbit." I think it's too sexy. I better not go on. But, but I mean, that's sort of what it was like.
But you
I
do specialise in the sexy voice, though. You talk about having done a sort of soft porn recording as one of your first jobs.
Actually, that's absolutely true. Yeah. I started on Radio 4, be fair, and then I graduated to porn. And it was because another actress in the drama repertory company told me that you could earn a bit of extra money doing porn tapes. And we weren't paid that much, so I thought, yes, I'll go and audition. And the auditions were held in the warehouse of the Ann Summers sex shop. And many of you will go there often, I'm sure, because you're the sort of people who go there. It was in Tottenham Court Road. Right. And I had to go in there, and there was this fleshy, greasy man. And he said, "Can you audition? Are you all right auditioning?" And I said, "All right, here's the script. And just give you everything you've got. And I want to see if you know how to do this. Have you had much experience of this kind of thing?" And I said, "No, not actually, not a lot of experience." He said, "Well, just, you know, breathe and give it everything. Just, you know, use your imagination. I wrote it myself," he said. And I could see that he really wanted to be praised for this garbage that he'd put in front of me. And it was really horrid. I mean, I didn't enjoy it a bit, but anyway, I got the job. And it was interesting because my eye was held by the items on the shelves of this emporium. And they were scrotum twisters, nipple clamps, and various things like that.
I've had a scrotum twister myself. It's not that much fun.
Anyway, I got the job, and I got 300 quid for doing it.
And did you ever track that? In the book, you ask if anyone has a copy of it, because your copy's gone missing.
I haven't got a copy, and I don't know if any of you have.
What's it called?
It's called Sexy Sonia Leaves from My Schoolgirl Diary.
It was a different time. It was a different time. Actually, it's about the same, to be fair. So, yeah, so, well, and there was a cigar commercial as well that was another.
Yes, was Mannequin Cigar. Mannequin Cigar Special. I remember that. And it talked about the kind of tobacco that it was made from. And it said, "Tobacco come from middle leaf best. Make mannequin cigar special." You have to laugh, don't you?
So, look, there's so much I want to talk to you about. Let's talk about... You were in the Footlights when you came to Cambridge.
Do you know what the Footlights are? Not everybody would know. The Footlights is a club at Cambridge for men at that time. Women weren't allowed to join when I was there. I'm fucking 80. I'm fucking 80 years old. Do you understand? So... In those days, they didn't allow women to join, and it was a club for men to prance about being funny. And every year they did a review, and they asked women to join, to audition to be a member of the cast. And I auditioned, and I was the woman in the 1962. That's how long ago it was, 1962 Footlights Review, and it was called Double Take. Do you know what a double take is? A double take is when you look at someone and you go like that. That's a double take, and that's what it was called.
Yeah.
And there were people in it like John Cleese, Bill Oddie, Humphrey Barclay, T- Tony Hendra, Robert Atkins, Tim Brooke Taylor, and it was directed by Trevor Nunn, and they were cunts, all of them.
It's very sad to hear. I mean, you write about it very, very, and you feel, and I'm sure this is true, because it's a sad thing that it maybe put you off doing comedy for a while, though you've done so much comedy that it's...
I'm not a comedian, you know. I'm not a comedian the way they are.
No.
Thank goodness in some ways, but I mean, they are brilliant. John and Graham and Bill, they were geniuses in their own way, but they were nasty people. They were unkind and they were horrible to me, and I've never forgiven them and never forgotten it. So that's why I say what I do.
When it came out, Bill Oddie actually tried to contact you on Twitter, I think, to say how...
Did he?
Yeah. I think he felt very upset. He said...
I'm not on Twitter. Twitter?
I saw him tweeting.
A woman of 80 doesn't do Twitter. What are you talking about?
But
Twitter? Oh, Christ.
He was saying he was doing all he could to get women admitted to the Footlights. But I just thought I'd pass that on. But he was...
Well, you know, he's probably grown up and he's probably sorry that he was so horrid.
Yeah.
But they were horrible because what they did, this is exactly what they did. They sent me to Coventry. I don't know if you know what that expression means. It means that you don't get spoken to. So I would do the show with them on the stage... And then I'd come off and stand in the wings for the next entrance. And I would just cease to exist. They didn't look at me or speak to me for the entire run of the show. And that was incredibly hurtful and made me very unhappy. And I've never forgotten it. And they also didn't ask me to the cast party. I was a member of the cast and I wasn't asked to the cast party. So I went to the president of Footlights and said, look, I haven't been asked to the cast party and I want to go. And he said, Miriam, it's an oversight, I can assure you. I said, it isn't a bloody oversight. They were just being horrible, but I want to go. And I went, of course, I did go. But I've never forgotten it. And you can say, what a crabby old bitch that I should remember that. And yes, I am.
Well, I don't...
But I think people should be called out for when they're horrible.
The interesting thing about the book, I think, is how... I mean, you talk about having 11,000 people in your mobile phone, something like that, that you how many friends you've made over your career and how nice you are about everyone. Pretty much every story is, we went on to be fantastic friends. So when you are mean about something, we know that it's for real.
It's for real. I'm telling the truth.
Yeah.
I wrote the book because the publishers wrote to me and offered me so much money, I couldn't believe it. I thought, well, I'm not turning that down. So that's why I wrote it.
Yeah.
It wasn't because I ever intended to write it. I never did. But now I'm jolly glad I did. You know?
Well, there's some very good a couple of revelations in the book that I'll say. I don't necessarily want you to say how you know that Leonardo DiCaprio, when you met him, was quite smelly. Bruce
he didn't want to wash.
Yeah.
He's not a smelly boy now. He's not. He's very fragrant. He's a nice boy. But when he was young, and this was when he was 18 or 19, he didn't wash. You know, and even blokes, I mean, women must wash. I certainly have to every single day, of course. But he didn't. He just sort of thought it was kind of cute to have that smell.
It's a funk, isn't it? It's a funky, the funky,
funky
smell.
He thought
teenager.
It was funky. I just thought it was horrid. but he's a very nice fellow, yeah. Actually.
Don't tell them. I'm not going to tell them how you know this, but Bruce Willis farts in bed. That's what I've learned from your book. But let's not tell them. They have to read the book to find out how.
Yes, you have to.
How you know, that. Arnold Schwarzenegger, who you worked with. You had a little bit of not falling out with him, but it was a little bit of falling out, but quite a funny story about what he did to you at the...
Yes, he farted in my face, actually, because I had farted on set but not in his face. I just sort of just happened.
Yeah.
And it came alone. It wasn't anything. It wasn't mixed with anything. And I thought that was fair enough.
Yeah.
And he obviously thought it was a license to fart. And he farted. I was lying on the floor in kind of dead in this film. I was Satan's sister. That was the part I was playing. And he lay over me and farted in my face. I thought he was awful. I didn't like him very much. Very professional. He taught me how to fight, because I had a fight with him, and he told me how to look as if I'd been hurt and how to punch him so it looked as if he'd been hurt. But he was a groper. Didn't grope me. He didn't fancy me. That was fine. I was grateful for that. But he groped everybody else, every other young lady on the show. And I think that's so tiresome. If only men realise how boring it is. It's so fucking boring.
Well, I think it's great that you feel happy to call out in the book as well that kind of behaviour. It's you know, because it's such a generous book, and your memory is so incredible. You remember people's names. You remember the name of a taxi driver you had in Cuba or somewhere like that. That you remember.
Oh, but he was lovely.
Yeah,
but Gilberto.
But
yeah.
Most people wouldn't remember. Most actors wouldn't have that kind of. Wouldn't.
But
care.
But I'm not like most actors.
No, you're not.
I'm me.
Yes.
So I'm different.
But also,
you know,
to remember is, you know, it's full of stuff, this book. It's incredible.
I'm glad you liked it.
No, it's really lovely. Good. I mean, I don't know where to start. Just this morning I was listening to your story about meeting the Queen, which I very much enjoyed. So you are quite, even though you're a socialist, you are quite a royalist.
Well, I'm not mad about the Queen, actually, although I think she's done a bloody good job, no question. But I really like Charles and Camilla. And I hate it when people are horrid about them in the newspapers and scornful. It's not right. They don't know them. People, you shouldn't be horrible about people unless you really know them. I mean, I really know the Johnson family. And I know how horrible Boris Johnson is. So... and his father. I had a week, you know those programs called the Real Marigold Hotel, when I go round with a sort of clutch of old people, and he was in the team 1 week, and it's a week I want back. He was horrible.
But the Queen, you finally met the Queen. And,
yes, I'm not going to go over the Queen story, because everybody knows the Queen story. But but she is an admirable woman, but I don't want to have tea with her. You know, that sort of thing. I think she's very good in her palace, and that's great.
I like the revelation that when you went to part of Prince Charles, that there's a chair there. Was it
yes,
Edward the...
that's fascinating, yeah. Actually. I had the amazing experience of being asked to a house party, or as they would say, a house party. And it was fascinating. It was at Sandringham. Now, he lives in Highgrove. I've never been to Highgrove, but every year, I think, he rents Sandringham. He actually pays rent to his mother. No Jewish family would do that. I mean, that's extraordinary. You give it to your son, you know, but no, she doesn't do that. She takes the money from him, and he rents it, and he has a house party. And I was one of the guests at this house party, along with Jeremy Paxman and Michael Moore Pergo, who's the children's author and he wrote War Horse. He's a lovely man. And David Hockney, the painter. That, you know, there were some really quite posh people there. And it was fun. I enjoyed it. I've forgotten what we were talking about.
We were talking about the chair. There was a chair that...
oh, that's what I wanted to tell you about. Yes. Well, when I arrived, he took me up. Prince Charles greeted me, and then he took me up. He said, "I want to show you this." And it was in the entrance of Sandringham. There's a very odd chair. It's a kind of wobbly, big chair, bigger than this, and it's wobbly like that. And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, it's actually a weighing machine." I said, "A weighing machine? You're not going to weigh me, are you?" Because I'm sensitive about being fat. And he said, "No, but I think it was his great-grandfather, Edward VII, who was the son of Queen Victoria, used to have lots of house parties at Sandringham. And he said he used to weigh all the guests on arrival and on departure. And if they hadn't put on weight, he thought he'd failed as a host." I thought that was so charming, actually.
Be annoying, though, wouldn't it, to have to be weighed by the king? It's sort of like a... feels like something in a Squid Game, to be honest. And it's, if you haven't put on weight, be very cross.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, look, you're very honest about your sexual exploits in this book. And for a lesbian, there's an awful lot of blowjobs in this book.
There seems to be a misapprehension that if you're a lesbian, it means that you don't like cock. And I don't understand that, because I don't actually like cock now. Not right up in my face sort of thing.
No.
But I didn't hate cock. I just... it was irrelevant. That was the thing. And... when you're a young Jewish girl, as I was in these late 50s and 60s, your parents, my parents, told me you mustn't sleep with anybody because you will get pregnant and it will be a shocking and sad thing and it'll make us terribly sad and it'll be horrible and you mustn't do it. And so I thought, right, well, I mustn't do that. That's out of bounds. But because when you're young, it's absolutely natural that you feel moist. You feel... you feel... you have feelings. The sap is rising. Your clitoris swells and, you know, all these physiological things happen. And if you can't sleep with somebody, you have to do something else. Well, the obvious thing to do is it doesn't go in that hole, it goes in that hole. And that seems to me to be perfectly fair. And nobody had said anything about sucking off. You mustn't do that. And I found I was rather good at it. And it was quite popular. So that's what I did.
Yeah.
I don't regret it. I didn't get any you know mouth ulcers or anything from it. But I think it did have one slightly lasting effect. I went to the dentist last week, and I got quite a bad gag reflex, and I think it might have been a folk memory of that. A fuck memory of that or something.
And there's a couple of stories as well, and one of them you told on the Graham Norton show, I know, about sort of sex pests and you sort of talk. Well, people getting their penises out, and there was a man wanking in a tree, which seems like...
Oh, in Scotland, yes, yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, he wasn't a threat to me, because he was very high up. And I truly just felt worried for him, you know, because the tree was shaking and he was shaking. And I thought, oh, dear, that could be very ugly up there. So I said to him, what are you doing? I said, come down at once. And I said, you're a soldier. I said, are you in the tattoo? He said, yes, I am in the tattoo. I said, well, you could get into terrible trouble. You could be dishonorably discharged. And, I mean, he was nearly discharging. So all that happened was that I asked him to come down onto ground level,
yeah.
And I said, I will help you out, and then you will go home and just pull yourself together and don't do it again. And that's what I did. And it went well. You know,
do you think it's an encouragement, though, Miriam, to reward? I mean, it's a kind of reward, isn't it, for wanking in a tree?
I don't know. He might have wanted to do it on his own. I don't know. I didn't really give him a choice, actually. Okay. I was a bit firm.
Oh, my goodness. So, we're going to sell some books tonight, Miriam. We're going to sell some books tonight. Look, there's a really interesting... I don't know if you want to tell the story now, but there's a very interesting story about how it was your father, I think, avoiding getting called up in World War I, which is a family story.
Well, that's a very sad story, actually. Shall I tell it? Because I think it might make people sad.
That's okay, we're allowed to do some... We're allowed to do,
can you do sad
we
things
can do,
here?
We can do wanking off strangers in trees.
Yeah.
And then we can move into something moving.
Yes,
and then
that's true. That's life. Yeah, I mean, that's what happens in life.
It is.
Well, my father came from a very poor immigrant family. They came from a country called Belarus, and they came to Scotland and settled in the slums of Glasgow, in the Gorbals. And it was a tough life. Anyway, when he was about 18, he got a scholarship to Glasgow University to be a doctor, to study medicine. But at the same time, almost the same week that he got the scholarship, the call-up papers arrived to go to France. It was it would have been 1917, just before the end of the First World War. And my grandfather was started off as a peddler, you know, with a pack on his back, selling little gifts and little jewels and what you'd call trinkets to the miners' wives in the lowland villages of Scotland. And he was so intensely proud of his firstborn, his eldest child, Joe, that's my father, who had just won a scholarship to Glasgow University. So when he saw the call-up papers, he knew that if his son went to France, to the Flanders fields where the battle was raging, the life expectancy of a young officer was 6 weeks. There was massive murder, and people were killed in their hundreds of thousands in the First World War. And his heart was broken, and so he decided to do a particular thing. He had the courage. He rang up the commander of the battalion, the 4th Battalion, Glasgow Highland Light Infantry, which was the regiment that had called up my father. And he went, made an appointment, and went to see the commander that afternoon in his office. So you have to imagine this sort of little old Jew in his best suit, not speaking English very well, nervous and frightened. And he knocked at the door, and the officer said, "Come in." So he opened the door, went in, closed it behind him. The officer, all in full uniform, said, "Right, what can I do for you?" And he cleared his throat, my grandfather, and he said, "Thank you very much for giving me this time to talk to me today. I come with a request, but I must explain to you first that my son received today the call-up papers to go to France with your regiment. And you know, and I know, that if he goes to France, he will not come back. And I come here to ask you today, please, please, take my son's name off the draft and give him a chance to live. He has just won a scholarship to study medicine to become a doctor in Glasgow University. He's the first member of our family to go to university. He is a good boy. He's a clever boy. Please give him the chance. But I cannot ask you to do something like that. I cannot ask without I give you something in exchange." And he put his hand in his pocket, and he took out and opened the palm of his hand and showed a diamond from his warehouse that he'd gone to get. And he said, "This jewel is a diamond. It is not a flawless diamond, but it is nearly flawless. It is the most valuable thing in my warehouse. I am a jeweler, and this is the price of my warehouse. I want that you should take this in exchange for the life of my son. Please, I beg you, take this and give me my son." And what do you think happened? Well, it always moves me when I tell this story, actually. But when I told the story in a show in Australia, there were two Scottish ladies who were in the audience, and in the interval I heard them as they went out. They said, "Did you hear that story about the Scottish officer taking a bribe?" "Impossible. That was completely made up. That was impossible.
possible.
He took it.
Yeah.
And my father lived, became a doctor, and became my father. Okay. And so I'm here.
It's an amazing, it's a baller move from your granddad, I have to say. It's an amazing, you know, it's an amazing risk for him.
What a risk he took.
But for
and
love,
what a risk the officer took.
Yeah.
But he, I mean, the really wonderful thing would be if he hadn't taken it and he'd still taken it off. Yeah. But he couldn't do that. So he took the jewel and he gave my grandfather his jewel, his son.
It's beautiful. It's an absolutely incredible story. And without that... Without that act of terrible betrayal of his country, we wouldn't have Miriam here. So
that's true.
Yep.
That's true.
But well done to him as well. The worst thing you could have done is taken the diamond and not taken him off the list. That would be the film version of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it does sound so like a. Like a story that would happen, that kind of decision that would happen in a movie. It should, you know, it should be a movie, possibly.
It happened, yeah. And I'm glad that he did that, obviously. And I think, you know, almost any father would do that, but you'd be afraid, wouldn't you? I don't know, because it was a bribe. I mean, it's a wrong thing to do,
yeah.
But. I don't blame him. I can't blame him. I really can't.
I mean, I think people didn't. You know, it's amazing that people didn't think to do that, you know, as well. So, you know, any father would do it, but most fathers didn't do
yeah.
it, so, yeah. presumably. There's also a story about your therapist who became your friend who revealed a sort of very dark secret about her life to you.
Yes,
which is an extraordinary story.
Yes, this is another very serious story. Yeah. You will surely know of the wonderful cellist Jacqueline Dupre, who sadly died with multiple sclerosis. And she was at the height of her powers. She was probably, you know, the greatest cellist we've ever had in this country. I've seen her only on film and seen her wonderful playing. And my therapist was called Margaret Branch, and I just loved her. She was wonderful. She called me a talented toddler because I was sort of not properly developed as a grown-up. Probably still true. And she one day she said... We became friends once we stopped therapy. You know, she became a friend of mine. And one day she said... I want to tell you something, Miriam. And she had a very staccato way of talking. She said, I want to tell you something. I don't want you to tell anyone until after I'm dead. So I thought, okay. So I listened. And she said, one of my patients was the cellist, Jacqueline Dupre. You've heard of her. I said, of course I have. She said, well, she was a great, great friend of mine. I treated her for some years. And then... Of course, she developed multiple sclerosis, a terrible illness, and she couldn't play anymore. And her husband, Daniel Barenboim, the pianist and conductor, he couldn't bear what she had become, this sort of shaking, incapable woman, and he left her and started another family in Paris. And her life was just not worth living. And one day, she said to me, Margaret, you know, my life is just not worth living. I want to die. And I said to her, well, Jacqueline, when you decide that you really do want to die, I will help you to die. I know how to do this because I was in the SOE, Special Operations Executive, during the war, and I was trained in how to kill people. And one day she rang me and said that she had decided. She'd given her staff the day off because she had people looking after her. And I went in to her home. I had the key. And I injected her above the hairline, which is what you do. That is how you kill people. You inject them above the hairline. It is you can't see it. It's invisible. And I took care to see that there was no record of my being there. I dusted everything, I suppose, and I left. And she died that night. Well, that was an incredible thing to be told, and I didn't know quite what to say or how to receive the confidence. Well, I just said, I probably, if I could have helped somebody, I would have done the same thing, I hope, but I won't tell anybody. I'm not going to tell anybody. And I never did until now.
Yeah.
And I put it in the book, and lawyers checked it out, and apparently because it was told to me, it wasn't something that I could be sued for telling on about it.
Sure.
But Daniel Barenboim, who's still alive, said, oh, this is nonsense, this is unverifiable. And it is absolutely true, that is true. It is unverifiable. Unless Margaret told somebody else about that, apart from me, who could substantiate what I said, it isn't verifiable. But there's no way that I would have told that story if it hadn't been told to me. I wouldn't have invented that. And I'm perfectly certain that it was true. That is what happened. But I haven't been sued, and I don't expect I will be. But it's also a story.
It's amazing that she put her confidence in you as well. It says a lot about you that she trusted you.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to shop her because she would have been done for murder.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to do that.
But someone else might have done. But also the fact that she obviously wanted to get it off her chest and then she chose you. It says a lot about you and the friendships you have with people.
Yeah.
That
I think so.
Yeah.
But anyway, it caused a bit of a fuss in the newspapers. And I was very selfishly worried that that story would become more important than my book. But it hasn't, so...
But as with so many things in this book, this is a little bit more... There's fleeting stories in this book that you kind of go, what? What happened? There's so much in there, but then to solve a murder that we're not, a mercy killing that nobody knew about, to have that in there is just an incredible thing to have in a book. And that's why the book, you don't know what's coming next is what I'm telling you. That's and we've seen that. You are such a fantastic actor, and, you've got that. I think you've done so much stage work, and the people might not know you for, and obviously people might know you from Harry Potter, or they might know you from Blackadder, or they might know you from these sort of comic and bigger roles. But you are this. What do you think the secret of acting is? Is it that you've clearly got empathy, but the emotion is so real that as you tell these stories.
I didn't go to drama school, so I wasn't really taught any particular method or way of doing things, and I think what I do, the only way I know how to do it is to read the text of the play that I'm working on and just keep immersing myself in it and trying to find bits of the person that fit bits of me so that I can draw myself into that character and pull bits of that character into me and just meld it so that I'm becoming another person. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way that I know how to do it. And I think I can be very good. It's true. And I can also not be very good. You know, I can make an absolute pillock of it. But I think I'm pretty good on radio anyway. I do think that. I think I'm a very good radio actress, and I can be very good, but not always, in other things.
Well, it's the range you have which made you, which was when you did.
Oh, it's the range
with that radio.
It's the range.
But you did an audition for the radio where you improvised a play basically with different characters on a train, right? And that's why you got the job, as a very difficult job to get in the team that were on the radio.
Well, I've always, when I was growing up, I was born in Oxford, which is why I have this very irritatingly posh voice. I don't want to be posh. I just am. And I decided that I had to find another voice in order to be able to be agreeable to people, because I think that a very posh voice is it puts you off people. It's not nice. I know when I'm in Australia, and I love Australia, my partner's Australian, and I go to Australia, and at first when I open my mouth they go, "Oh my God, can't believe anybody can talk like this for real." So I borrow the other bit of me, which is the Scottish bit, which I heard always growing up with my father, so that I can just put on a Scottish accent. It just comes out like that, and it's just very easy. And you know, if I'm in the street and I want to know the time or where the bus stop is or whatever, I just go up to people and I say, "Excuse me, sorry to bother you. Where's the bus stop here?" And it's much nicer for them rather than if I say, "I'm so sorry. Could you?" So it's been useful being able to reach people in that way.
And it's not like totally unusual, but I found with a lot of times with actors, and especially great actors and people who play lots of different parts, you kind of lose, they sometimes lose the essence of who they are, or it's very difficult to find the real person behind some character actors. I find that, you know, they're never themselves. Whereas I think the essence of you, Miriam, is still, when you're you, you're very much you. You're a real person. Do you not?
I fucking hope so.
Yeah, but many actors.
I mean, of course, I.
A lot of actors lose themselves, or are doing it because they're not. Maybe they're not so strong a personality themselves that they put on personalities. But it feels you're Miriam Margolyes.
I've always been like this. Yeah. I've always been me, and in some ways, I'm quite a confident person because I know who I am. But I want to be like this. I've chosen, yeah. Amazing though it may seem, I've actually chosen to be this person. And I didn't know that it was going to make me money to be like that. That was a bit of a surprise. But it's turned out very nicely, really.
There's also, within the book, you see it, but I think you see it when you're interviewed and when you talk to, is, you know, the honesty that is disarming. So, like, most people would, you know, think, "Oh, well, I don't want to talk about this, or I won't mention that story." But you're honest, and therefore I think it means we trust you, and, you know, that's...
Well, you have to be honest. You can't do business with liars. And that's the problem with Boris Johnson. You really can't. I mean, I'm sure that there are many members of the Tory party who are decent people, and they must be utterly shocked and disappointed at what's happened. This shower of incompetent, corrupt buffoons running our country and running it into the ground, it's absolutely terrifying. So we have to get them out. So you've not to vote Tory anymore, that's all. I just...
Yeah, you lot... You. Well, one would hope so. I mean, I don't. It seems, Miriam, that people will. I don't know what they have to do. They're putting shit in the sea, and people are going, "Yeah, that's fair enough.
I don't know.
That's a good place for it."
I don't know what the answer is. I'm not political enough to know the solutions. But I can tell you that the problems are there and real, and they are. Partly because people are lying. They lie to us. And we accept it. Why isn't everybody outraged? You know, it's wicked. We're being led by the nose by these bastards. I just can't bear it. And I feel very angry. And so that's why I talk about it like this, because it does shock me. I don't want the country to be like this. It's dreadful.
It's true. And you're honest about yourself as well, which I really like it. And I like the fact that You talk. I mean, I like the you talk about. Is it was Endgame the Samuel Beckett play you were in?
Yeah.
That you just talk about not liking the play or understanding.
Well,
the
I didn't understand it at all. I don't understand Beckett, but I was really good in it. I mean, that's one of the things I was good in.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I tell you, there was a rather wonderful thing. Samuel Beckett is a great Irish playwright. Very difficult to understand what the plays are, but they are wonderful plays. Waiting for Godot was one of his plays. It's a great, great play. But you don't have a clue what's going on. But it's gripping. Anyway, in this play, Endgame, I played one half of an Irish old couple. I was Nell, and my husband is called Nag, and we were down in a dustbin. That's where the play was set. We were in the dustbin, and then there was Mark Rylance and Simon McBurney who were not in the dustbin, and they were a couple of very weird people. And Simon was the director. And I said to him, you know, I really don't know how to do this. I didn't know how to act it. And he said, well, we'll find the way as we go. And we did. And he gave me a piece of direction which was so brilliant and helpful. He said, you know that time when you're talking about your youth, and because she goes into this little soliloquy about when she was young, and he said, I want you to stroke your hair as if you remember those days when you were young. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting piece of direction. Okay. And so I did this gesture as I was talking, and I just touched my hair and remembered my youth. And everybody who saw the play said that that moment was very strong and made the character have a life and a memory. It was just, you know, when you're thinking about yourself in the past, and you just, it lifts your face, and your eyes fill with memories, and it got across the footlights, and it was a bloody good performance. So, you know, and that was all due to Simon McBurney.
I mean, you talk about, I mean, your career, I mean, it's still ongoing. If you look at your IMDb page is just full of new credits, things that aren't out yet, things that you've recently done. So you're working and working, and you've worked all your careers, 60 years or something like that.
It is amazing. It's amazing because, you know, when I've always been fat, I've always been short, I've always had no neck, and that is a real deprivation, not to have a neck. I mean, it's bad enough when you're driving, you sort of can't see round you. But I've managed to make a living. I really have, and that's amazing.
Now, this is a question I ask everyone, and I'm not trying to be morbid, but
Death.
Well, it's about death, but what do you think, out of all those roles, when your obituary, which I hope never happens, Miriam, and maybe it never will, comes out, I hope you'll live forever, what photo do you think will be used from your career to illustrate your life?
Golly, I never thought about that. Well,
do you think it's been taken already, Miriam, or do you think it's something to...
No, I think it will be me as Mrs. Gamp.
Right.
Me as Mrs. Gamp. Now, Charles Dickens... Yeah, Charles Dickens, you know who that is?
they're not 5 years old, they're growing people, they know.
I know.
They're very intelligent people, they know who Charles Dickens is.
The main thing is they're not American. because Americans haven't got a clue. But the English know that Charles Dickens was a very great writer in the 19th century. He was born in 1812. So he was actually born in the Georgian times before Queen Victoria, and he died in 1870. He was 56 when he died. And in that really relatively short life, he wrote some of the most glorious novels that were ever written. I think he's as great as Shakespeare. He's He's our window into the 19th century. We see the 19th century because of the way that he showed it to us. And I absolutely love him. And he created over 2,000 characters. That's a huge amount of people that he just pulled out of his brain, out of his imagination. Absolutely amazing. And one of the characters that he created was a drunken midwife called Mrs. Gamp. And she always went about with an umbrella. And I don't know if you know, but you can call an umbrella a gamp. In Victorian times, it was called a gamp after her. And in Victorian times, midwives had two jobs. They didn't just deliver babies, they laid out corpses as well. So when the door knock came and they were called for, they didn't know which duty they were being called upon to do. And Dickens describes that as Mrs. Gamp had a face for all occasions. It's just a brilliant description. And I do Mrs. Gamp. I did a play called Dickens Women, and I did a lot of the characters, and she was one of them. And Mrs. Gamp has one line that I always loved to say. She was always pissed. She pretended she wasn't, and pretended she was, you know, a very good nurse and very honest and so, but she used to say, "Leave the bottle on the chimney piece and don't ask me to take none, but let me put my lips to it when I'm so disposed, and I will do everything I've been engaged to do according to the best of my ability." That's Mrs. Gamp. And the photo that will be used will be me as Mrs. Gamp. Yep. That's what I think.
Well, that's apt, a face for all occasions, which yes. is very much,
yes.
very much what you are as well. So it's Well, there are other things to talk about. Let me ask you some emergency questions.
Emergency?
Emergency questions. I don't need them, but I just feel like I should ask. I have all the people in the world. I think I should ask you some early ones. I won't ask you number one.
I want to know what number one emergency question is.
You've done it for other people, but you can't do it for yourself. have you ever seen a ghost, Miriam? No.
I deal in reality, not in nonsense.
See, that's unusual. Most actors have seen ghosts because
fuck 'em. Maybe they have.
Most actors are mental, Miriam. Most actors are mentally ill.
I haven't.
I'm glad. It's my test to find out if someone's crazy or not, and you're not.
I've never seen a ghost. I've never seen a ghost.
Never seen a ghost. Have you ever seen a Bigfoot?
What is that? I've seen a big cock. I've never seen a Bigfoot.
The question of actually just falling across here is, yeah. Would you like to give me oral sex? So that is the question 139.
Not now, darling.
I feel like, you know, it would be, I'd be part of a...
I don't want to give anybody oral sex anymore.
Everyone I've seen is just...
I want chicken soup with matzo balls. That's what I want.
Oh, and you have another claim to fame, which is the first person to swear on TV.
Yeah, well, that's hardly a claim to fame.
It is a claim to fame.
I got an answer wrong in University Challenge. Well, of course I said, fuck. I mean, anybody would. But I just happened to... The camera was on me and, you know, so they bleeped it out. But, I mean, I'm not proud of it. It was just obvious. Anybody would.
All these things that you say anyone would do, you're still the only person who's, who has done them. And I was quite interested in you got whisked off to Hollywood, and you starred in a sitcom in America, which I don't think many people would be aware of.
Yeah.
Here.
It was a disaster.
Yeah.
But I was indeed very good in it. It was interesting. It was called Franny's Turn, and it was about a Cuban woman that I played, who had a very sort of old-fashioned husband. And she was a feminist, and she was trying to teach him how to be a new man, the new way of being. It was such fun. I loved it. I loved doing it. I loved the company that we worked with. And it wasn't popular. It didn't go. So there we are. It just failed. And the interesting thing is that in America, certainly in Los Angeles, everybody's frightened of two things. They're frightened of fat. They're frightened of catching fat. And they're frightened of failure. And it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, you have a failure, then you get up and work a bit harder and you have a success. I mean, you just got to go with the flow and not get too upset about it. That's what I think, anyway.
Well, when was that? When did you go out to America? What decade was that?
Is this a fresh glass?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you never can tell.
It's that's a soldier's
nice.
Semen.
That's nice. It's what? Yes, it is. I think I'll have a bit more of that.
But you did get, you know, you did. You obviously went on. Was it the 80s that was it? Because you obviously it didn't harm your career, even though in America you sort of talk in the book about how just when there's a you talk about seeing you talk about seeing someone's show. It's Rowan Atkinson's show, isn't it? America and the notice
yes,
came
that,
out.
Yes, that wasn't. That was not. Rowan at his best, and it didn't go well. But he is brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's wonderful. I love it. I love him.
But at the after party, everyone just disappeared.
Yeah, that was horrible.
Came
that was awful. You know, it's silly to be like that. I think they have too much of a cult of celebrity or something over there. No, I mean, I stayed in Hollywood and I had a very good time. And the thing was. I met a chap, Norman Lear, who's a very well-known television producer of great comedy shows. He was the producer of All in the Family, which was the American version of Warren Mitchell's great success.
Alf Garnett, yeah.
Alf Garnett. Till Death Us Do Part. And many other shows. And he paid me. He met me and he liked me and he thought, I'll make a show, I'll make a series for you. And he paid me $350,000. And I didn't have to do anything, not even suck him off. Nothing. Nothing. He gave me this incredible amount of money just to be in America while he worked out what I should do, what show I should be in. I couldn't believe it, you know, that. But it was absurd. I mean, that's absurd. But it was fun. It was lovely, you know, and I had money and I had a car and a flat and I had a nice time. It was lovely. And then the show went on and it was a failure. And from that moment, nobody spoke to me again. No social life, no phone calls. But you pick up and, you know, you get on with it. But he was lovely. But the really wonderful thing was that all the money that I made in America, I used when my father, God rest his soul, needed nursing care at home with me, he lived with me, I was able to pay for it. And that money that I made in America was what kept him looked after and alive for 4 years. And then he was 96 and he died. And I feel so happy that I had the money to do that, because most people don't have that sort of money. You, and care is expensive. This is the problem with in the health service. They've taken the care section out of the health service, and people have to put their, don't have to, but they put their families in these terrible places sometimes, and they're not treated well. It's a scandal. Now, I wanted to have my father with me, but I wanted as well to be able to earn a living and go out to work and be an actress. And the only way I could do that was if I had the money to pay nurses to look after him. Then I would come home at night and he would be all clean and looked after and happy. And I only had that money because of the money I made in America. But I can hold my head up. I say, I took care of my father at home, and I used the money I made to do it. That's why... thank you. Well, that's why I wrote the book. Because nobody's going to look after me. But I have the money to do it.
Well, it seems to me that your brain is still fizzing, you're coming up with stuff. The book's really genuinely well worth your time.
It's great. Buy it.
Do buy the book, because we need to keep you going for as long as we can. And have you got work in the pipeline? Is there stuff coming up?
Yes, I have. I'm thrilled. One of the things that's happened in my life as I've got much older is I've started to do documentaries. You know, that's programmes... where you don't have to...
They know what documentaries are. They know what documentaries are. How dare you insult my audience? Come here and insult my audience.
Of course they do. Of course they do.
He doesn't know. He doesn't know.
Well, these documentaries, I'm going to Australia on January the 14th, and I'm going to make 3 programmes about Australia. I've done 3... in Victoria and Northern Territory and in Queensland. Now I'm going to do them in Western Australia, South Australia and Tasmania. And that's great fun, because you go round and you meet people and you talk to people and you ask questions and you learn things, and I absolutely love it. And I told them, I do it in a camper van, and I said, I will do it, but I must have a toilet. That is the absolute... I will not leave the country without a travelling toilet. And I've got one. So that's good. And I've just done a film in Wales about cancer called My Happy Ending, with some wonderful actresses. Andy McDowell, you know, from 4 Weddings and a Funeral. Tamsin Gregg, Sally Phillips... Raki Thakra, who is in EastEnders, and David Walliams is in it too. It's just a delightful, heart-giving film, wonderful. And I've done a documentary with Alan Cumming around Scotland, which will be out in the middle of November. And that was great fun to do. He's a lovely bloke. And I'm going to be on the Graham Norton Show on November the 5th, which is another... And they pay you for that. You know? So they don't pay you for this.
They don't know. You're getting paid for this.
Am I?
Yeah, not as much as Graham.
What am I getting?
500 quid. It's all right, isn't it?
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Your agents kept it from you, Miriam. They're trying to squirrel that away. They say, oh, it's for publicity, Miriam. You don't have to.
That's lovely. Fine. Thank you.
That's all right.
I didn't think I got anything for this. Well, anyway, I mean, it's been very nice coming to talk.
Well, it's been very nice. There aren't many living legends, Miriam, but you are a living legend, and it's absolutely fantastic to have you do it. End there, Leicester Square Run. Ladies and gentlemen, Miriam Margolyes! You have been listening to Rahul Astapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Miriam Margolyes. Thank you, Descant Regard. They play the music on the credits, and that is why I'm thanking them. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. He's still eating a sandwich, the same one from last week. It's insane. Thank you very much to Chris Evans, not that one, for all his work. And thank you very much to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre for having us during this immense run. It's been great to be back. Thank you to all the audiences who came out to see us live or watched us on the live stream. You make our lives just worthwhile, my fan friends. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Why not? I don't know. Go to GoFasterStripe.com/badges and get a badge. Look at RichardHerring.com for information of upcoming Rahulastapa gigs. And hey, why not just tell your friends about this podcast? Ask them to listen to 100 episodes this week, and that will help us make some more money to make more podcasts. Or just one episode. Ask 100 friends to listen to one episode. And if they then listen, they tell 100 friends, and all those 100 friends tell 100 friends, then soon we'll be billionaires and we'll use our money for evil. See you soon, bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to RichardHerring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.